Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Reporting from Burnaby, British Columbia, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Nalox Home is a nonprofit society that provides destigmatizing public education services that inform youth throughout British Columbia on how to identify the signs of an overdose and how to effectively use naloxone in the event of an overdose. Naloxone is a medication used to reverse or reduce the effects of opioids, and its usage has only increased in importance as the opioid crisis in BC has continued. This is something that was recognized by Chloe Goodison, a health sciences student at Simon Fraser University who began the organization during her first year of university in 2021. CJSF recently sat down with Goodison to discuss what inspired her to start Naloxone, the work that they continue to do, as well as the ways in which she hopes that the organization is able to grow beyond BC. Please take a listen. I'm joined here in studio with Chloe Goodison, the founder of Naloxone, and I think the first thing I want to ask you is if you can explain to people what Naloxone is and how you came about starting it.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me. Naloxone Society is a registered Canadian charity that I started almost 4 years ago when I was in my first year at Simon Fraser University, actually. It is a education service, and we go into high schools. Teachers can book us anywhere across Canada, but we really target British Columbia. And we can go in and we provide drug education and naloxone training workshops in response to British Columbia's ongoing and deadly growing overdose epidemic. We're a team of all youth, so I have a team of 85, 18 to 25-year-olds on my team, and we go in and provide peer-to-peer, youth-to-youth drug education and naloxone training.
You said you started this in your first year.
Yeah.
How does a first-year university student even think to start a nonprofit society?
Very good question, and it kind of happened by fluke, if I'm being honest. When I was in high school, I first of all, the overdose crisis was declared in 2016, which mm-hmm. is the year that I started grade 9. And it was grade 10 going into grade 11 that I was on public transportation, knew nothing about the overdose crisis, had maybe heard the word, and I witnessed an overdose, which is not rare. It's not a news flash story that I saw. We've probably all walked past somebody experiencing a drug poisoning. And this is what really got me involved in the realm of drug poisonings and harm reduction. And I really was surprised that I was witnessing this in my own community of Port Moody, British Columbia. In my head, I thought all drug use and overdoses were isolated to the downtown east side. And this was just a preconceived stigma that I had based on basically no exposure to drug education. Then I entered my first year of university in 2020. So it was online and I did have a little bit more free time because there wasn't volunteer opportunities in clubs and sports happening. So basically, I was scrolling on Facebook one night and I saw an ad from SFU's Office of Community Engagement that they run an annual community engagement competition. It's called the Student Community Engagement Competition. And this is an opportunity where you can enter a idea of something, a way to fix a problem in your community. You have to identify community partners you've connected with, and you can compete to win $3,000 to implement this community project. So I thought, okay, well, I've been volunteering in harm reduction for a while. I saw this drug overdose on SkyTrain a few years ago, and nobody knew what to do, despite it being a declared overdose crisis. How can I find a way to provide accessible and equitable drug education with naloxone training that youth will actually listen to? So I got 12 of my friends, all also in first year, and we met up on Zoom, and we just had this idea, and we just brainstormed a curriculum and what items are important to talk about to youth. What should youth be knowing about our drug overdose crisis? And I won that competition. And since then, we registered as a society. We've got a lot more funding than $3,000. And like I said before, we've grown our team to over 80 people.
How do you develop the presentations?
That's a great question. So really, in that original brainstorming session I had with the team I put together at the very beginning, we went through the topics that we thought had to be included. Like, how do we give youth a very well-rounded understanding of this problem? And it starts with talking about stigma and talking about, you know, what are the current ideas we have around people who use drugs, and what... is that true? And we, you know, we walked through some language swap outs that we can use. Instead of saying addicts or junkies, we say people who use drugs or people who are in a relationship with a substance. So it's really starting at ground zero there, and then working into talking about harm reduction and what is harm reduction in a non-drug related sense. You know, do you ride your bike? Do you wear a helmet? Do you put sunscreen on in the summer? All examples of harm reduction. It just makes sense. In the same way that naloxone or drug checking services just make sense. They keep people alive. From there, we really wanted to get into some statistics around how hard-hitting the overdose crisis is in all parts of our province, not just the downtown east side, not just Surrey Central, every pocket of the province. And then the bread and butter of the presentation is the naloxone training. So we took this presentation to a partner we had at the Tri-Cities Community Overdose Action Team, where it's a team of different community members and problem solvers, like a Fraser Health official, a SHARE Family and Community Services representative. And they looked over our presentation and trained us on how to deliver it in a sensitive and culturally safe way. And from there, we trained each other and just launched in and made sure everything in our presentation was 100% science-backed and accurate.
Yeah, would you say part of that stigma, too, is taking away some of that fear of even being around naloxone itself?
Oh, 100%. You know, something we've had a lot of parents and students say before they've actually seen our presentation is that carrying naloxone is enabling substance use, which is so, so incorrect. And we definitely found that students have been scared to, we've actually found that 75% of students didn't know about naloxone and didn't know how to use it, didn't know you could get it for free. So we're really myth-busting that and just providing that education that students can go get a life-saving naloxone kit. But there is that the portion of students, too, who are scared, and they're scared of needles, which is fair, and we've educated them that there's multiple kinds of naloxone available, not just needle naloxone. But I'd really say that there's still that public misconception that harm reduction enables substance use and that drug education in schools enables substance use, but it does not. It's not correlated with increased substance use initiation.
There was pretty recent data from the province saying that there's apparently been a significant decline in drug deaths within BC, about 9% since last year. Would you say that's kind of like a statistical anomaly, or is there any sort of, I guess, information you have, you know, with the work that you do, that may provide some insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's a mixed reaction for me, because of course, part of me is like, oh my gosh, something is maybe working, like something is contributing to a decrease in deaths. But it's still way too many deaths. These are our family members, our community members, our loved ones who are dying at higher rates than anything else. You know, this is still our leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 59 in British Columbia. So as much as we can maybe hold on to a sliver of hope that something's working to decrease, whether it's, you know, increased access to harm reduction services or less people using alone, hopefully those elements that maybe are happening are continuing. But we also have to remember every single drug poisoning death is preventable, and there are still far too many happening.
Yeah, it's such a multifaceted issue, but I guess with naloxone specifically, I think it seems like the part that you're trying to address is like the stigma around it and making sure that drug education matches the seriousness and the prevalence of the issue.
100%. You know, I never questioned receiving sexual education in school. It's just what you do. You learn, you teach young people how to make informed and empowered decisions about their own health and safety, same way you would about substance use. And by continuing to put our heads in the sand and pretending that talking about drug education in schools is just going to make youth want to use drugs, that's not the truth. And we have to provide young people with the tools to not just prevent and recognize, but also respond to an overdose. Because personally, if I had received this workshop in school, I probably would have thought right off the bat, I don't use drugs that I'm at risk of illicit drug toxicity with. So I'm not, this isn't going to connect to me. But why we, how we've tried to navigate that narrative is by saying we can all witness it. This is our leading cause of death. Over 35,000 people call 911 each year for suspected overdose. We're all at risk of witnessing an overdose. So knowing how to not just prevent and recognize, but respond, carrying naloxone, saving a life, it's important.
And yeah, like you said, I guess comparing it also to just other basic safety protocols that we just have in our daily lives that are so normalized and feel like second nature, getting to that point.
Totally.
Last question I want to ask you is, if you have current plans or aspirations for how you want naloxone to grow, past even BC perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, what I've learned is that there's a need right across Canada, North America really, for youth-to-youth delivered substance use education. And yes, there are other vehicles of substance use education. You have your programs that preach just say no. You have your programs that are led by police officers coming in and using scare tactics. Our overdose numbers have really just gone up. Of course, yes, there was a bit of a decrease, but that's not because of the DARE program. So yes, we need to find a way to scale this model of having young people just chatting with their peers about how, hey, drug use is happening. These are the tools available to keep you alive. So, I mean, next steps are really just expanding our in-person operations province-wide. Right now, we're pretty far across Metro Vancouver. We'll do anything Vancouver to Mission in person. But, you know, getting an island branch, getting a northern health branch, a interior branch going, just so we can really get into those rural and remote communities that are so disproportionately affected by our drug poisoning crisis. And after that, it's hopping into other provinces. Every single day I have emails from Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, these awesome community advocates who see the work we're doing and recognize that there's nothing else like it, and they want to develop naloxone society branches of their own out in their regions. So that's really the next step, just scaling and capacity building and fundraising for that. But I'm continuously impressed and motivated by the community support. We've had an overwhelming number of people cheer us on, and a very, very slim number of people who do not agree with the work we're doing. So I'm definitely motivated, to say the least.
I know I said last question, but I guess last thing is, you know, you're still in school. You're a student at Simon Fraser University. Yeah. Post-graduation, is the plan to really focus on naloxone and the ways that it can expand?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm just finishing up my Bachelor of Science in Health Sciences right now, and I'm so grateful to be part of a faculty that's so understanding of the work I'm doing, and they're so supportive. And, you know, my professors are always asking me questions and engaging with me and understanding that I do work, this is my full-time job. So balancing the full-time student course load with the full-time entrepreneurial lifestyle, I suppose, is challenging, but I find ways to take breaks. However, it will be very nice once I have achieved that Bachelor of Science and I have it, and then I can, you know, really be full-time and continue scaling this out and driving this change and eventually, you know, stepping out of the role. And I probably want to do more school. So finding who's next to lead this youth-run organization and what other change can happen under other leadership. But that's way in the future. I'm here for now.
Once again, that was our interview with Chloe Goodison, Executive Director and Founder of Naloxone. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This interview would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. According to the BC Coroner's Service's December 9th Unregulated Drug Deaths Report, the cumulative number of unregulated drug deaths in 2024 is 1,925. This represents a 9% decrease from the number of deaths during the first 10 months of 2023, which was 2,107. Currently, the annualized rate of death in 2024 at 41 per 100,000 people is less than the annual rates in any of the previous 3 years. That's 2021 to 2023. While 1,925 people is still significant, there is a marked improvement across BC as it pertains to the average of unregulated drug deaths. However, the highest rates of death so far this 2024 have been in the Northern Health Unit. That's our region. 71 deaths per 100,000 individuals. Clearly, our region is facing challenges. Jordan Stewart, founder of the Pounds Project, joins us over the line today. Pounds is a nonprofit in Prince George, Clayley, Tanay that works towards harm reduction by way of safe consumption and community outreach. Jordan, do you have any thoughts on the particular challenges our area is facing and why so many people in our community continue to die while other areas are seeing some improvement?
Yeah, so I think sort of like the simplest way to explain that this actually was a bit of an anticipated trend is that, like, if we look at it through the lens of epidemiology and sociology, there's a theory, diffusion theory is what they call it, and that explains sort of like the predictable and gradual way that, like, behaviors, diseases, trends, innovation, products, technology move from high-density areas to lower density areas. And so when this toxic drug crisis began in BC, the southern parts of the province are more densely populated areas around Metro Vancouver, started to see sharply increasing overdose rates at the end of 2016. Was when overdose prevention sites became legal. The public health emergency was officially declared in 2016, but it wasn't until 2018 that Northern Health started to see those same increase in overdose rates that were, like, very slow, minor increases from 2016 to 2018 in Northern Health. And then in 2018, we started to see these massive spikes. So that kind of, like, 2 years behind Vancouver trend is explained by diffusion theory. And it's one of the contributors here to why we're seeing those rates at, like, a big level. And when we break it down to, you know, the nuances in the north that have further contributed to this, it kind of comes down to access to services for people who use drugs. Again, the population density and the consistency and connectivity of networks, whether those are like peer-to-peer professional networks or health systems in the north, and then some logistical and infrastructure barriers that are compounded by some institutional factors to do with Northern Health and then social dynamics in northern communities. Like, it's not that we expect to see amounts of fentanyl in community or in drug supply decrease. It's about other services like preventative and protective measures being ramped up to essentially, like, meet the level of fentanyl and, like, toxic drugs in community. And so what we call, like, the iron law of prohibition is that prohibition equals potency. So as long as we prohibit substance, it will continually become more and more potent. So we are under, like, our current criminal code and the way that we view substance use in Canada, our current policies do not predict any kind of decrease in the potency of illicit substances. All we can hope for is that services and essentially, like, coping strategies of communities and people who use substances will increase to the same rate that toxic supply is in the community so that they can kind of counterbalance one another.
Hope is that if a supply is regulated and made safe, the concentration and general toxicity of what is available would then also commensurately decrease, at least in theory.
Yes.
Okay. Are you able to speculate at all on why there is a decrease at all within our province? Is there an improvement in services? Is the unregulated drug supply somehow less toxic now than it was? What factors might precipitate this?
There are a few things that I can sort of hazard a guess at. I do, and I think a lot of folks in this field are viewing this decrease in areas in the province and like the provincial average overall with an abundance of caution, given that this is quite similar to the decrease that we started to see prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, and then was followed by quite considerable spike again in those rates. So we're certainly not, you know, sure that this is going to last forever. We have seen, you know, in other areas of the province, a ramp up of a wider variety of overdose prevention services, so more inhalation sites, which are very, very limited in the north. Prince George has one safe inhalation site that has only been open for a couple of months. There are only two other communities in the north with supervised or monitored inhalation sites. There are, again, like more services available for treatment and stabilization in other regions of our province. And then there are also more robust peer networks in terms of people who use drugs and finding sort of backdoor solutions to this problem. Like Dolph obviously ran a compassion club that was wildly successful in terms of providing a safe and reliable regulated substance to people with substance use disorders. That program doesn't exist anymore, but there are, you know, individual players that have taken it upon themselves to access sort of similar avenues for accessing those substances. And that's definitely a harder thing to tap into in the north.
You mentioned Dolph earlier. Is there a particular model that is in place either somewhere in BC, past or present, or even anywhere in the world that you're familiar with that you feel could really benefit our community as far as safe supply goes?
My favorite model that I've read or seen is a model that was used by Providence Healthcare in Vancouver. And it involved a pharmacy dispensing program for fentanyl. And I believe it was fentanyl tablets that were being offered through that program. But essentially, it was a prescription-based program, just like other prescribed alternatives in D.C. But it allowed individuals to access, like, regulated, consistent doses of fentanyl, which was and is the substance that most people using an illicit supply of opiates are physically dependent on at this point. And they were able to go to a pharmacy up to however many times a day that their prescription dictated and purchase a dose of fentanyl at essentially a street-level price. So that removes the incentive for diversion. Because if I, as a consumer, have to go to the pharmacy and purchase fentanyl for what it's worth on the street, there's no financial incentive for me to sell that to somebody else. But it guarantees that medical oversight in terms of accessing those substances and ensures that it is regulated, consistent product, that people are getting the same thing every single time, that they know what to expect. And that cost management piece there, I think, is what really makes it stand out in terms not only of reducing the incentive for diversion, but also speaking to some of those societal misconceptions or reservations about prescribed alternative programs. You know, we hear a lot about people being very angry that people who use drugs are sometimes able to access a safe supply of free drugs, you know, given that they're covered by pharmacare benefits in BC. And so if by introducing that little bit of, I guess, capitalism into the healthcare process there, I think it would go a long way to appeasing some of those societal concerns.
That is really interesting. Thanks for sharing your insight on that one.
Northern Health was contacted for comment, but was unable to provide a response in time for publication.
If people are interested in knowing more about the Pounds Project or supporting your operation, how can they learn more?
You can visit our website, thepoundsproject.com, or check us out on Facebook.
Appreciate your time.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a safe and happy holiday season. As 2024 rounds to an end and people begin to turn their brains off for 10 glorious days, there's one morsel of statistical importance that remains in the heart of the people who work for free expression and access to information in Canada. Access to information from government organizations in Canada and the legislation that protects publicly funded agencies, such as Indigenous Services Canada, all the way to your local municipality, have become more protected and expensive to access this year, according to Canadian Lawyer magazine. This year, according to Globe and Mail's Secret Canada reports, over 176,900 federal requests have been made from the public and journalists for public records, a growing number in a trend of more and more government agencies hiding behind legislation that protects their right to secrecy for various reasons. However, under BC's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, the public's access to documents can be refused if they're for sale. The law also does not put any restrictions on how much a government or department or agency can charge for access to documents, according to Freedom House, an American organization that exists to advance policies and strengthen democracy as well as protect human rights across the globe. The Canadian Center for Free Expression has continued to work for the advocacy and education of Canadians to exercise their democratic right to access public information, and December 31st of this year is the deadline for anyone, citizen or journalist, to nominate a government or agency for outstanding secrecy of publicly accessible information. The award deadline for this year is coming up. Do you have like an idea of how many nominations you have this year?
I know we have quite a number.
Yeah. Are they mostly from journalists too?
A number are from journalists, because journalists probably do more access to make more access to information requests than any other category of people in Canada.
Yeah.
But there are also requests from members of the public, from civil society organizations that are trying to find out what their city council is doing, or from healthcare coalitions that are trying to find out what the provincial government is doing.
Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. If you're a journalist or maybe even a member of the public, you might have tried to file a Freedom of Information request to a publicly funded agency like the RCMP or even your local municipality. Access to information and the effectiveness of Freedom of Information or FOI laws vary significantly across countries. The Global Right to Information rating or RTI rating, developed by Access to Europe and the Center for Law and Democracy, assesses access to information worldwide. And according to this rating, countries such as Mexico and Serbia are recognized for having robust access to information laws, whereas Canada falters in that category. Here's Amanda Follett-Hosgood, the Tyee's Northern BC reporter, explaining her experience just in this last year of requesting FOIs.
2024 was kind of the year of FOI for me. When January began, I was looking at doing three different Freedom of Information inquiries through BC's Office of the Information Commissioner. So through, for people who don't know how the system works, you file your FOI request to government. They have a certain amount of time to respond to you. And if you have any concerns with their response, or if you don't get a response, you can make a complaint in BC to the OIPC. The OIPC's role is to try to negotiate a solution between the person requesting the information and the public body. And if they can't do that, they will put your request in a line for inquiry. And you can wait up to a year or two for your number to get called and to begin that inquiry process. So starting in January, government lawyers will file their argument, and it can be a, 100-page long legal argument about why they shouldn't have to release the information. You respond to that, they respond to you, and then ultimately the information commissioner makes a decision, and it's a binding decision about whether or not the government has to release that information. So it was a pretty steep learning curve, very time consuming, and I can't say that I got a whole lot of information in the end. I think of the three inquiries that I took part in this year, one of them was a partial win where the government had to release a little bit more information. at this point, it was so old that it was kind of irrelevant and I didn't do much with it. But what I learned, which was interesting, is that through the FOI inquiry process, the government, as it makes its